Accession number 14972, Richard Atkinson, Creel 8.
Mr. Atkinson, Reel 8. You were going to tell me of an incident in the Red Sea, Mr. Atkinson.
It's colours, Dick. Well, we came up the coast towards Egypt. We didn't know it was Egypt, but we're into the Red Sea. We pulled into Aden Harbour. When I went out, no one was allowed ashore. And by the way, this was the 5th of July, 1941. Remember it well, it was my 21st birthday. That's how it sticks in my mind. Next thing we looked, bum boats alongside and officers going ashore. Murder, why can't we go ashore? Anyway, we weren't allowed. And as the officers came back, we got the hoses out and turned them on them. And the officers come, which was, well, wasn't military discipline. It's called mutiny. So eventually got the officers aboard, and they rounded so many men up, you and you, and it was a court-martial offence. We don't know what happened to those fellas to this day. So I'll never forget the 5th of July 1941 in my life. Neither will the officers. I got the hoses turned on them, to be honest. So,
yeah. You then landed where?
Port Chufet, Egypt.
What was your very first impressions of Egypt?
Oh, couldn't fathom it out. Scruffy, higgly-piggly, like nothing on earth. Of course, we just came off the boat and the trains, troop trains. But and it drove through the outskirts, you're amongst the houses, and that railway was running along the street, in the street. But it was filthy, stinking, queer. Never seen anything like it before in real life. Thought France was bad, but that was 100 times worse.
Where did you go to?
Amarilla, on the canal zone to acclimatise. But I mean, that was our first thing. The gypos, we call them Egyptian gypos, was coming aboard the train, flogging stuff, eggs and bread and postcards, and we were throwing them out the door, not coming in. As the train was going, you're throwing them out one door, not coming in the next door. But we went into the canal zone, Amarilla, in the acclimatise.
What was that camp like?
It was just a tented camp in the sand. Alongside the canal, you could look out the tent flap and see a boat going past at the bottom. Big vessel. But it was, you lay around for about a fortnight, I think it was. You used to do, anything that had to be done was done early in the morning. If it was a parade, a rifle inspection, or a kit inspection, or getting anything, it was done early in the morning, and you just lay around with a towel over you on account of heat, getting used to the heat for about a fortnight, 3 weeks.
Was a high standard of turnout and dress still insisted upon?
Well, yes. Yes. And you begin to take a pride in you're washing your shorts every day and getting a nice crease in them, and you had small putties. Like long putties, but only small round, and horse tops, and were things they'd never ever seen before. And you know, and it was, you're taking the pride in this new uniform because it was completely different with light. And the sun topies that you're issued with in England, it had a cover like what the Marines wear now, was that type of thing, the same as that. And you carried them all the way to Egypt and you threw them away when I got the Chufik, threw them in a heap on the quayside. He just wore the old fore and after bling. So.
Did the heat have any effect upon you?
At first, it tired. You just wanted to lie around. You're sweating like bulls, and sweating madly. But you got used to it, and then you start to pick up normal army life.
It didn't affect you immediately in any way for dysentery,
Thing. Well, that actually just let you. If they're doing anything, you did in the cool of the morning. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and they just let you lie around and get used to it. There was no ceremonial parades or things like that.
No training?
No, nothing. There was nothing. And there was no transport. No, there wasn't a thing there. And then they...
What was the food like? Had it changed since coming from England?
Yes, it's a change. What come on, the tin fruit and stuff they got, which you never saw in. Yes, it changed. Sweet potatoes or yellow and stuff like that. And somebody said it was camel meat. It was terrible meat, but this, yes, it changed. Because it was you're getting Indian and Australian stuff and things like that. It wasn't come from England, it was coming the other way by this time. And at night time you're allowed to the naffy. And there's also naffy and things like that. Open air cinema, things like that.
Was the hygiene of the camp good? I think in terms of toilets.
No, it was just the usual trench like what you had on the building sites with a pole across it, and because you had your sanitary corps, well, as they had to look after things, but it was just very, very basic. It was, you know, the trench with a hole in, and they moved it when it filled up with lime and moved on a bit further over.
Did you have any problem with heat stroke or
yeah,
burning?
No, flies, but millions of flies, but no problem with heat stroke. It didn't. They seemed to let us get into it nice and easy, and there was no stupid parading in the midday sun and stuff like that. But flies, you had to eat your meal, you were wafting flies off your plate and things like that. You couldn't. There was a fight between them and you who got the food, sort of thing. Never seen number and size like in my lives. Millions.
And that would be difficult to get used to.
It was very, very difficult. You know, at first it was putting you off the food, but you got... Learn how to put your plate on top of your cup of tea to keep the flies out, and keep wafting one hand over your plate while you're eating with the other one, and things like that. But and somebody could buy a fly whisk, you know, one of these long-haired things, and but they were constantly there, even when you're walking about and things like that. You were constantly bothered with flies, and that was the army's biggest worry. They didn't want them because they were the disease spreaders, and they were keen to stop things, but they couldn't. There was too many, too much of it.
Were you there long?
I think, I guess it seemed now like 3 weeks, a month, something like that.
Where did you go to?
Then they shipped us across to Cyprus. They put us, went down to Port Said, which is beside Chuvik, the naval base, and I went down to the Manxman, the fastest navy mine layer there was, and you just crowd on the decks, anywhere under the guns, anything. The Navy man was at that station, and you sailed for Cyprus. We didn't know it was Cyprus, we just knew under the cover of darkness.
You hadn't been told where you're going?
No. Durham's never told you where you're going. You found out there when you got there. There's also a mystery tour with the Durham's. We landed from Augusta.
What are your memories of landing there?
Oh, we just come into the harbour and come off in the...
Did you get off the ship easy?
Yes, because you all had your kit. You know, the Navy lads was pleased to see you because they had been stuck at the action stations all night. I mean, they come around with cocoa and stuff all night for you. There was, you know, the try, because the deck was only a foot above water. You could put your hand over the side, and the speed they went, you couldn't move round. But they accommodated you and they helped you, because I suppose maybe some in their quarters below, but I was one of the unfortunate ones that was on the deck under a gun turret. Because when you got to Cyprus, it was completely different. You weren't allowed to move during the day because the Italian planes used to fly over reconnaissance. There's no movement whatsoever during the day.
So immediately you got off the boat. What happened to you then?
Well, I can't remember correctly, but there's no transport. But they must have had transport because they took us up to a place called... I'll never forget that name either. Cato Lacetamia, John side of Nicosia, a little village. Village, 4 or 5 houses, you know. And you just slept under the hedge, around the side of the fields. But you weren't allowed to move during the day. Then at night time, the RAF, the Navy used to come, Fleet Air Arm, with 2 or 3 trucks, and these string bag planes. Used to help them put the torpedoes on, and used to fly out in the Mary. And if they come back, the next morning, I hadn't seen anything before that torpedoes with them. Often, as I landed, the torpedoes fell off and rolled away. But, and he used to help them. Somebody said, well, building an aerodrome for them, but I don't know. You're digging and that. But it was just through the night. You weren't allowed to move through the day because this Italian plane used to come over reconnaissance, like a little spot in the sky. But that was what they told us.
Now, what were you particularly doing?
I don't know, nothing, to be honest. The I had an officer called Mad Robbo. I was supposed to be his driver.
And what was his full name?
Yeah, there were all the pubs out in the town. His daughter was asking, oh God. It'll come eventually. Robinson. I don't know his first name, but you also have that Mad Robbo. Because money, again, was no object to these fellas. I mean, those the same millionaires, I don't know. But they all had business in those days, so no. And they'll go out, officers together, get drunk and have a merry time, come back, and the sentry will be doing his job. And they'll go around ripping a few tents if under canvas. And they say, there, the sentry wasn't alert, and the poor sentry would get in the neck. He had been doing his job. And they just paid for the damage, and it was all forgotten. But you were scuffing around in the middle of a night, trying to get the tent patched up. But that's how we got the name of Mad Robbo. Well, there's no transport. So this is the type of man he is in this story. This type of man he is, he decided he'd buy a donkey. Maybe his driver, I would look after it. I know, I didn't know which end was the head or the tail of a donkey. I'd never seen one in my life. Said, well, he gets his donkey. He says to me, Atkinson, look at him. He was going to ride around his donkey. His feet would have been on the floor if he had sat in the back. And I looked at it and I says, well, there's no way I'm going to look after them or do anything with them. He wants to get a mule tear or something like that. So the cooks had big blowers in those days, petrol blowers, and they used to pump them up. And a big flame used to shoot out and heat about five Dixies on a stand, you see. Cook's blowers go on their back, the donkey onto that, and it disappears. Never been seen to this day. Mad Robbo's donkey, what's it he's got? But that's the type of man he was. He never asked where they'd gone to, either. He said, it's disappeared, sir, and that was it. But I can remember making knife rests, you know, barbed wire knife rests and stuff like that. But, you weren't loved out at night time. Then again, we decided, Hokey Walker and I, he was the MT clerk. His name was Norman Walker, but again, nickname Hokey. He says, Dick, we'll go to Nicosia. I says, we're not allowed out. He says, I'll be all right, man, we'll get a lift. Civilian transport was running around. So, we goes to this road somewhere. Oh, the MO had a truck, because Stuart was his driver. People like that had a transport, you see. There's two or three transport, but not much. And we wheeled this truck down. It was one of those trucks, like wheels, with three or four big tree trunks on the back. So he gets in the cab. There's two drivers and him. He gets in the front. Not room for me, so I climbed onto the three logs like a triangle. I sat in the top. Going down the road, you had to carry your rifle with you again, as usual. And I could see him gesturing to the driver in the cab. He must have said to him, can I have a drive? Gets behind the wheel and gets out of control. And I knew it was going over, so I fastened my rifle under my applet and it turned over and I was underneath it, dropped. Now I can remember somebody saying, well, get an artillery quad, and they pulled it up and I come out and put my nose, I've got a scar right on the side of my nose, it was split wide open and I was taken to the English hospital, doctored up. And we never got to Nicosia yet. But the justice in that in Cyprus then was English. Police dressed like English policemen and everything. Gordon actually, court of inquiry and whatnot, and he blamed bad English. He said the driver asked, could he drive? And he said, yes, I can drive. And the driver left go to the wheel, thinking he wanted to drive. You know, he got over that way. And when they come to me in hospital, I said, oh, I was on the top, I know nothing about it. I don't want to know anything about it. But I think the driver was charged with careless driving or something, but he got out of it. They never asked him why we were there, or we shouldn't have been there. They never asked him. But that's a trick she used to get up to. Because there was nothing you could do, to be honest. We didn't know what we were doing.
What were the people of Cyprus like towards you?
Didn't have any contact with them. There was only this little village in there. Well, there was Greek Cypriots who couldn't speak the language. English was spoken, but whether they could speak, I don't know. They didn't speak. Well, you're only allowed to move at night time while you were in their places. You never had any contact with them. The MO did and things like that if there's any trouble.
And you say that you were defending airfield.
Well, we're making an airfield for the Fleet Air Arm. Supposed to be, I don't know, but this is just a road they're using as a runway, whether doing anything with it or not, but that's what we're supposed to be our duties.
Did you get transport ultimately?
No. Well, I had odd ones, but no, there's no transport allowed. wasn't big enough. Well, we thought it wasn't big enough, but it was quite a size. But no, we had two or three trucks, which they might say to me, Atkinson, do this and do that. Or the MO was, can you drive us somewhere to take an ill? Thing like that. A lot of VD on that island. The special part of the hospital I was in was just VD alone, with civilians and everybody. But I couldn't understand the object of being there, to be honest.
So if you weren't driving very often, what were you doing yourself?
Well, nothing. It didn't seem to be any object. We used to help the fleet head on at night times and things like that. And somebody says we're digging things for to make an aerodrome, but it didn't seem any sense or reason to it, to be honest. It didn't seem any object whatsoever.
Were you involved in, did they organise sports and leisure activities for you?
No, there's nothing moved through the day. Just at night time. No, there's nothing.
That went on all the time you were there?
All the time we were there. We weren't there that long. A couple of months. We weren't there that long.
There was no place that you went to for leisure activities, being there whatever length of time you were. You weren't sent to a place to relax.
No. I think we were there 2 months, that was all, 8 weeks.
Where did you go to after that?
Well, the pulse boards. Naval vessels brought us back again under cover darkness. I'm not sure it was Egypt or Palestine, to be honest. Because it was Palestine then, could have been Haifa. And got transport, and we drove across the Sinai Desert into Iraq.
And what are your memories of that journey? Because that was rather a long one.
Yes, it was. And you went across this desert, barren thing, nothing. Just a pipeline. The oil was come from Iraq in those days into Haifa, in the Mediterranean, for shipping. There's a huge pipeline with pumping stations, and you just followed that. And you drive all day, it was just stony. I kind of place where it was, but I know we crossed the River Jordan because the colonel stopped and he got some water. He said, holy water. But the Jordan, what I thought was just like a little ditch, but I don't know. But he stopped there anyway. Because we weren't, wasn't far behind them. And each day you drove along this pipeline, then at night time you'd come in as what we call the flims. These 4 gallon cans was laid out in rows and rows, and you drove the trucks in, that was petrol. And you filled your vehicle and that up. There was a stage, they just called staging posts. And it must have been a service call, but they were laid out. Nothing, there's nothing in sight, never saw anybody. And you come up with these things, laid out these lines, and you filled up a vehicle, your vehicles and that, checked them, and you moved on the next morning. No names on it, it was just in the middle of the desert. And then the first big place we came to was Habaniya, which is a huge RAF town, city. It had roads, street lights, swimming pools, but evidently the RAF had ruled by air then, and it was a major staging post to the far east for the RAF. And we were in there one night and we had a bath and it was like come back to civilization. And then we moved on the next morning to
Moving on, it would take some time. So we were staying out in this desert area, whatever, at night.
Oh, well, you didn't unload trucks or anything. You just stopped and refueled them and made sure everything was intact. And you didn't take anything off. Then the next morning you just in and drove on again.
Did you sleep in bivouacs, sir?
No, just the trucks again. The transport always slept in the trucks or on the trucks. You know, next to the wheel or above the wheel.
Where had your transport come from?
Don't know. It came.
It was there in effect in Haifa when you waited for it.
But there was Indian vehicles, Chevys and all sorts. It was.
Were they reliable?
Well, somehow, no. Joe Madison, our sergeant, was a good sergeant. He could all beg, borrow, or steal, but he always finished up with reliable transport, and he had good fitters, and the Remy man, he was attached to it, he was good in the armour. But if it wasn't good, it would suddenly be lost, and a new one would be produced from some of the units' marks on it. But they had a lot of Australian markings and stuff like that. And
did you come across any natives on the way up?
Well, you saw Bedouins and that, you see the odd one, but you didn't come across any,
Didn't have any warnings about them make steal from you, anything of this.
Oh, you? Yes, you're well warned about that. Rifles, odd times rifles have gone missing, which you never saw. You're warned about that. But that happened in Palestine as well. The Jews were just as bad as regards that. I shouldn't say the Jews. The people of Israel was just as bad at that time. But you had to sleep with your rifle, but they used to disappear. Of course, it was a court-martial offence if it went. But they did. And in the desert, in these deserts, what we call them, these odd ones disappeared. Because we never come, and then our first contact was Baghdad. When we come into Baghdad, because you suddenly come off a desert onto a road, just started and finished with nothing there. And as we come through Baghdad, the stoned us. The officer I was driving got hit in the face, got hit in the eye with a stone. I didn't know they didn't like us. I mean, we didn't know, these political things. We didn't know the RAF had bombed them years ago and kept them under control. We didn't know anything like that. Because then we just drove straight.
So you hadn't been warned about this before you entered the city?
No, nothing. No. We just said, oh, great. Oh, look at them. Bang, the stone came through and hit them. Because there's no cab or anything like that. I think it could have been the intelligence officer, a fella called Stogo, that was riding with me there. Because officers wasn't allowed to drive, They weren't allowed to drive. It had to be a driver. Tell you what to do, where to go and whatnot, but they weren't allowed to take a wheel. And we just drove straight through up to Mosul and Kirkuk. We used to call it KK. That's where we were, on the Euphrates.
As you approached those areas, was there any change in the terrain or the conditions of the road?
It got very mountainous and hilly and cold, bitter. I experienced snow 8 foot deep. Never, couldn't believe it after being climatized 2 months before. To get every quarter round, turn a vehicle over by hand and stop it freezing up. If you took your boots off, you couldn't get them on the next morning, they were frozen solid. Still asleep in the backs of trucks, and the fellas was in under canvas.
And you never got under canvas they were?
Well, you could, in that they were improvising fires in the tents. Oil dripping and water dripping in the smoke, the tent was black, to try and keep warm. But we should go to the Turkish, but for the transport, you find an excuse to go into Kirkuk. KK for a Turkish bath, Mosul, to get warm.
What were those places like?
Oh, they were atrocious. The Kurds, and they're still the same now as what they are then. They were hovels, and we were talking about they're calling them towns, but the usual Middle East thing. Everything seemed higgly piggly and just catch up next to each other and things like that. Didn't seem to be any organisation.
Did you have any problems with the natives?
Oh, yes. They didn't care much for us. No.
In what way did they show up?
Well, somebody decided to steal a sheep one day, and the fella fired at them. Things like that, you see, never got the sheep, but the fella fired his ancient rifle at them. You didn't talk. These are odd ones to try and flog your eggs. And that. You never saw a hen, but he said, try and flog your eggs. And you said, try and diddle them by selling them tea leaves. But there was no real contact with them. There used to be little huts where you sell buns of some sort. But the army didn't encourage you eating that stuff because you didn't know what you were eating. And any fruit, anything, which you never saw any, but if it had a skin on, you had to peel it. And if it hadn't, you had to wash it and count its crystals, count its, on account of infection.
What were you doing there? What was your job?
Nothing. I think someone said it was a case that Germans came through the Caucasus Mountains. I think. But we didn't seem to be doing anything.
You were digging defences at all?
No. I don't know who the lads was, but I never saw any. And we just used to go to the Euphrates and wash the vehicles. I actually didn't move the vehicle because it was froze. But I never saw a snow lake in my life.
How did you get through that situation that winter?
Well, it was shocking. It was terrible. I think we just sort of survived, to be honest. There was nothing arranged. There was nothing done. Now, I talked to a fella in the 8th Battalion. He wasn't there. He wasn't even a driver. He was a signaller. And they got all those together and said, right, there's a vehicle. And they were driving Russian evacuees, women, down from somewhere into Palestine. He says they drove that long, the soles of their boots dropped off, and the women, filth on the wagon that was stopping it, you know, that business. He said, run off the wagon. Now, that's what the Abertown did. The ninth never moved. I don't know what the sixth did, but he was a signaller, and they got that job.
How did you film then? How were you filling your day?
Aimlessly, to be honest. Just trying to keep warm and phone the end for anything I wanted doing, anything like that. And sometimes you used to escort, if there's any supplies going through to Russia, you'd escort them so far on. You know, if it was a train, you'd drive alongside the train. Because the whole train, locomotive, anything, was just handed over to the Russians. And but you only take it so far, and it would go on itself. But we didn't seem to be doing anything. We seemed to be aimless. But the 8th Battalion had a job, well, some of them, getting these refugees out of Russia, wherever it was, and into Palestine.
Did you have duties to perform?
No, not that I know of. I know they put a marquee, must have been maybe it's Christmas time again. Well, yes, it must have been Christmas time, because God knows. And they put a big marquee up, and we had a Christmas dinner. Did I see the Christmas dinner at the drums of Sacrosanct?
What did you have, you remember?
It would be turkey, if I know the drums. It would be turkey, so as it was tinned from a nappy, but it would be there. Because I can remember putting a big marquee up, and we had to shovel all the snow, you know, put it on the snow, and I would shovel all the snow. It would just go and stand up like a buffet, I suppose, but at least the drums made sure you had a Christmas dinner.
How was the cooking done in such a wild area?
Well, just these cooks with these petrol blowers things, these pumps. And there were stands with holes in, and the Dixies used to fit on the holes. And I think they could put about five clipped together in this pump and used to throw a big flame along and cook that way. And you smelt the snow for water because it was pure. And then somebody came up with this ingenious idea of dripping dirty oil and water together. And used to pew, pew, like a flamethrower thing for heating and cooking, but it didn't work, it was too dirty. But somebody, they stopped at the fence, it was so dangerous.
What was your usual daily ration made of?
Well, it would be whatever was in that area, like sweet potatoes, or was it? Because there's no lines of communication that I could see, to be honest. There's no lines of communication. So it must have been like sweet potatoes or whatever potatoes was in the area and vegetables and stuff that was going. It must have been sufficient because none of us died through hunger.
What was the health of the battalion like?
Well, it was quite good. Well, it was no good going sick because you couldn't go to hospital, I think. I mean, I don't know if division was up there. Well, 151 was, but I don't know if division was up there or where they were. Because you never saw them, but I can never remember if anybody then were having to take anybody to hospital or anything. So there must have been no appendicitis or anything like that. There mustn't have been.
Were any sports or activities organised?
Nothing like that. As I say, it was just snow. It was a matter of trying to keep warm and doing what was necessary.
Did it affect the morale of the battalion?
Well,
so?
I think it was getting pretty low by this time. We know we'd had a. Just nothing happening. There was nothing to ginger you up, and yeah, I think it'd be getting low by this time. I don't suppose you would survive much up there, and the brought us out, of course.
When did they bring you out?
Well, shortly after Christmas dinner, so it must have been around about the January 42. That was the,
and when
January 42.
And in effect, you retraced your steps.
The battalion did. Then again, you see, it says to me, Atkinson, job for you, get the truck ready. This Captain Stoker was an intelligence officer, and a fellow called Scott Beatty. And then he never was called Scott Beatty in his life, was always Pie and Tatey, as usual with us. And I came with him, I can remember driving down to Damascus. And he went into Turkey. I think he went as military advisor. We never saw him again. I was offered the option of, they said to me, you can have civilian clothes and finish. Oh, no, I'm going back to the lads. But he, and afterwards, somebody said to me, oh, he went in as military advisor to Turkey. Well, it was a civilian job. And Stoker and me came through Damascus. I can remember stopping in Damascus, just sleeping on a truck in the streets. Them two went away somewhere, I just stopped in the truck. Complete stranger. See, that was the sort of thing, it didn't worry you. Never been there in my life, never saw him. And we came down through Palestine to Haifa and joined up with the regiment. They were coming down the staging post again into Egypt.
So you'd gone to Damascus just to drop this chap off?
Yes.
And then came over and